It's time for Q&A with Joe Ray. Call Joe Ray now at 646-721-9887. That's 646-721-9887.
And it's Monday, and that can only mean one thing here on KRBN. It's time for QA with Joe Ray. And on the line with us right now is the star of our show, Miss Joe Ray Perkins. Hi, Joe Ray.
Hello, Robin.
This is the first time you heard that intro. What do you think?
Oh, I like it. I like it. I like the little rhyme. Rhymes are fun.
It kind of
fits. For some people. It does.
Anyways, I'd like to invite people to give us a call. We're live right now at 646-721-9887. That's 646-721-9887. The chat room is open. We can take your questions there as well. And Joe Ray, are you taking questions live or off the air again?
We're going to go off the air, so people can email them to me at Perkins, the number 4, Oregon at gmail.com. That'll get to me the fastest way. We do have several questions that came in, so we'll probably start with those and see what else pops up tonight.
Okay. You want to start out first by telling people who you are and what you're doing?
Yes. So, Joe Ray Perkins, I live in Albany, and I am running for the U.S. House of Representatives 4th Congressional District. And so to give folks an idea of what that area entails, it is from Linn County south. It goes down to Jackson County, skips Jackson County completely. Grants Pass is not included, so gets most of Josephine County, Curry County, Coos, part of Benton County, Douglas County, and Lane County. So there's 7 counties altogether in the district. So it's the second largest geographic district in the area, but that's what I'm running for.
All right. So do you want to head right into the questions, or would you like to bring us up to date on how the campaign's going?
Well, the campaign is going. We're getting more and more supporters every day. I do have my candidate statement for the voters' guide has been approved, and so with the state of Oregon, you have 2 options to put a statement in the voter's guide. You can either give the state of Oregon $2,500 or gather signatures. We have until February 25th to get the signatures done and in, and because they need about 10 days to verify those signatures, we need to submit 300 signatures of people that are currently registered voters or registered voters as of the day that they signed the petition that are registered to vote in the 4th Congressional District. So that's currently what we're doing. And if folks want to sign that petition, they can just drop me an email, perkins4oregon.com, and I will email that petition to them. They can sign it as a signer. They sign it as a circulator, email, or not email it, but snail mail it back to me, and we'll add that to the list. So they give us just over 4 weeks to get all this done. Not an easy task, but doable.
And how many do you need again?
We need to turn, well, we will turn in probably between 400 and 500 signatures. We need 300 validated.
That's a good margin.
Sure. So one of the reasons that a signature can get declined is maybe somebody forgot and they signed the petition with me, but then somebody else they know is circulating a petition, which we've got people all over the place circulating these petitions. Oh, yeah, let me sign that. Well, so then they go through and they verify, and they go, oh, Robin Simmons signed it twice. There go 10 signatures right there because the entire sheet the state can disallow. So, no, it's not just one signature. It's all the signatures on that page. The state has the right to go, oh, they're gone. So that's why we like to make sure that we have a very large margin. So yeah, we just like to be sure.
Yeah, and any long-time Oregonian knows that it's hard to get all the signatures validated.
It is. And for people that are not registered to vote, and we'll talk about the voting here in Oregon, but if you're not registered to vote, you can actually register in about 60 seconds. You can go right online to OregonVotes.gov and click on the Register to Vote link that takes you right into the Secretary of State's office, or website, I mean. Identification you'll need is a driver's license or Oregon ID card. So for people that have, since the first of the year, since January 1 or 4, as the case may be, have gone into any of the DMV offices, if they are not registered to vote, they're automatically registered to vote. So they're registered as non-affiliated voters, and they will get something in the mail from the Secretary of State's office saying, we've registered you to vote. You have the choice of joining a political party, leaving it as is, or opting out and unregistering. Well, we don't know on that law, and it's a state law, but just so that people know, we don't know that if, let's say that, Robin, you went in and they've registered you to vote and you opt out. Right. Well, then 6 months later, you need to go back to DMV because you got another vehicle and you're going to register that vehicle. Are they going to turn around and register you to vote again? I don't know. Maybe somebody knows. I haven't read that law. But anyway, so register to vote. And when people are not voting, and this is just a really huge issue in this state, especially if you are consider yourself to be conservative or evangelical or both, a lot of people go, you know, I like this person, but I just don't like them well enough, and I really don't like the other candidate, but I'm just not going to vote. What they just did is they essentially just gave two votes to the person that they really don't want to see get elected. So their vote, or excuse me, their non-vote makes a huge difference. So please vote. We live in the greatest country in the world, even with all the issues we face today, Robin. And people need to exercise their right to vote. There are people in many countries who literally die for the privilege to vote. And when they do get to vote and they get their, and we've seen them all in the news, they get their thumbs printed. They do a thumbprint and they come out showing their purple thumbs. They were so excited that they got to vote. And even many of them, Robin, know that they're also dealing with a corrupt system, but they still got to vote and express their wishes. So
absolutely. By the way, I want to give the phone number out one more time, 646-721-9887, because I don't have a call screener today, but I'll try to take your questions off the air. If you'd like to ask Joe Ray a question, if you're on the line, just push 1 and it comes up on my board that you have a question. You can also send the question to talk@krbnradio.com. I'll get it right very quickly, and we have 20 minutes to talk with Joe Ray. And you want to start hitting some of the questions here?
Sure. What questions do we have tonight?
Well, let's start out with one of the big one. How about, let's start off with what your opinion is of the overreach of the federal government. How about that?
Overreach of the federal government. Oh, man. If ever there was an understatement, I think that's it. Everything that the federal government is supposed to do or is charged with doing is in the Constitution. It's so simple. It's so succinct. In fact, the entire Constitution, including the Bill of Rights, is around 4,000 words. So we scratch our heads and we go, well, how is it that the government has gotten so big? How could this even happen? Well, it's because the people aren't paying attention. And this is a government that's of, by, and for the people, not of, by, and for the elected, and today we would call them the elected elites. So what is the government not supposed to do? The government is not supposed to be meddling in state matters. The Constitution says these things not specifically enumerated herein are left to the states, and those are states' powers. We commonly call it states' rights, but they're states' powers. So every state is a sovereign unto itself. And so every state can make its own laws as long as they are not in contradiction to the Constitution. So let's take some of these departments. The U.S. Department of Education. The only place that that would show up in the Constitution has to do with that the government would fund for sciences and the arts. So that's not the only place that it's going to be. Everything else, again, is left to the states. Bureau of Mines, excuse me. Yeah, the U.S. Bureau of Mines, that is land. You know, to go into a mine, into somebody's land, it's going to be held within a state. So what's the federal government doing going into land that is owned by the state or the people within the borders of that state? So where do they get the authority? The Bureau of Labor, land management, I'm sorry. What, again, same thing. What are they doing going in there? So we see all these violations that are constantly going on. And so what's happened is the government has gotten so big and so bloated that they become this monster that has to be constantly fed. And then they come up with all these problems that we didn't know that we had before. So every time there's a new problem, there's a new agency. Every time there's new agencies, there's new administrative rules. Every time there's new administrative rules, there's new employees. New employees mean new costs. New costs means we don't have enough money. We need more of yours.
Exactly. I have a question from a caller. They would like to know your opinion on the teacher strike, about how you feel about teachers striking for more pay.
I do not believe that teachers should get to strike. I think I need to back that up a little bit with going back to the turn of the last century, back to the 1900s, back when unions were being formed. There were some reasons why there was a need for some sort of representation or legislation in regards to workers' rights. There were definitely horrible working conditions, and things needed to change. So unions had a place 100 years ago, and they did some good things. For the majority of today's industry, we don't need labor unions. This idea of management against the worker is, again, one of those problems that I just mentioned that really they don't exist, but somebody created a problem. When somebody goes into teaching, to being a teacher, they know, or they should know, what to expect. They should know what's their pay going to be, what's the working conditions going to be, what is expected of them as a teacher. And so for them to say, well, no, I want I can't remember what it was, but this last year up in Washington State, there were some teacher strikes going on, and they wanted an outrageous raise. Who pays for that? The money doesn't just come out of thin air. Well, some people go, well, the government pays for it. Where does the government get their money? They take it from you and me. So every time they take money from you and me, that lowers our buying power. The bottom line is teachers should not get to strike. You took a job. Your job is to educate the students. That's your job. And you should be able to have a free market where you negotiate your salary. And if you're not willing to work for the salary and benefits that are offered to you, then you are free to go look in some other school district or in some other industry. So I think it is wrong. I think it is horrible to always use the children. It's for the children. It's for the children. Several years ago, when the retiring head of the National Education Association, and this is, you can find this on YouTube, was retiring, is a huge rally in some big arena. And he stands up there and he says, Do we do it for the children? And the crowd screams out, no. And he goes, do we do it for this? Do we do it for that? And every time he would say that, the crowd would scream no. And then he goes, why do we do it? We do it for the power. And the crowd, Robin, goes absolutely nuts. Had I not seen it with my own eyes, I would never believe it.
Wow.
So, no. When you have a job, your job is to do the job. You shouldn't be thinking about striking. I currently work full-time at OSU. I will tell you, the faculty instructors are not union, but classified, or all the office support staff are union. And that is a lot of people that do a lot of things on campus. And they were working on the contract negotiations, and the union kept throwing things at the university system. And they would come in at the last minute, oh, we want this, we want that. So the union representative, one of them, comes walking into my office, and I have fair shared out of the union, although they still take money out of my paycheck. And they wanted me to sign a threat to strike. And I said, no, I have a job to do. We have an education to provide for these students that are paying a lot of money to be here. And my job is to be here for the faculty, for the students. I have a job to do. I will cross a picket line because I will not strike. And they looked at me and left. So, you know, I have a job to do. And it's not to be constantly threatening to go out on strike so that I can get a raise. So I don't think that they should get to strike. The Supreme Court is hearing the case right now on whether or not a person can be forced to join a union in order to have a job. So several states have right to work states. Oregon is not one of those. The closest that we come here is fair share, where we can opt out, but they still take money supposedly just for administrative cost. It's a lot of money. So the Supreme Court is hearing that. It sounds rather favorable that people will get to work in government or for anywhere else and not be forced to join a union. We won't know that till probably June before we hear that decision. But there you have it.
All right. Well, speaking of schools, since we're running, we got about 12 minutes left in the program, other questions that people have written in. And Joe Ray, one more time, how can they get a hold of you to write a question for you to answer?
They can send it to my email. They can go to perkins4oregon.com and contact us tab. So that's the easy way, perkins4oregon.com, or they can send an email to perkins4oregon@gmail.com. Either way, it ends up in my inbox.
Absolutely.
And I will answer it. Normally, as long as I still have the time, they'll get an email usually before the next day with an answer, or we'll save it and answer it here on the show.
Absolutely. And a couple of the questions that we're answering today is from callers and from emails, and we have some more questions from the email. And this one I'm kind of curious too, is that if anybody knows what that 7 plus 3 equals 11 means, so what's your opinion on Common Core?
Yeah, so Common Core. So Common Core started off with an idea through the Governors Association. So all the governors belong to this Governors Association. They were coming up with, well, how can we put this together so that we can try to unify or make consistent education across the state. So if little Johnny moves from Albany, Oregon to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it's the third week in January and he's in the fourth grade, he can just go into his new classroom, sit down, pick up a book, and he hasn't skipped a beat. So that's the idea behind Common Core initially, so that to have a standardized education system. Then the federal government got involved and started putting strings attached to it and threatening the states that if they did not adopt the Common Core standards, that they would withhold the federal funding for education. Again, the federal government does not belong in education. This is a state's issue. If the states want to join together and say, hey, let's work on this, let's see if we can make it work, that's fine, but the federal government needs to have its hands away from it. It's not their job. What you just described is what they call estimization. And it is somebody's idea of a way to teach children how to do math. The problem is are they really going to grasp it? I was helping one of my grandchildren last year, fourth grade math, with understanding, fifth grade math, understanding a question. It was a word question. which we all love those. I had to read it several times before I could finally get to what it was they were asking, and they were just basically asking to explain how all the different ways to do this calculation using cubes once I got through all the stuff. But people are getting hung up on this estimation. Now, we estimate all day long. Well, about how much is that going to cost? Oh, you know, it's going to be, I don't know, about $20, okay, give or take a little bit. So we do that on a regular basis. But what they're doing at the school level, at the education level, is if little Johnny says, the question is, estimate what 4 times 7 is. And little Johnny says it's 28, he's being marked wrong because he didn't estimate. But his answer is correct because 4 times 7 is 28. So that's where the frustration is coming in. And I don't know. I'm not a teacher, but I just don't know that that's really going to bring about the results that they're hoping for. And one of the biggest frustrations in Common Core is teaching to the test. And so the kids are learning enough to pass the test and not learning the material.
And that's why when they become checkers, they can't count change.
Right. There's so much. Talking to the faculty, the professors, instructors at the university, there are so many students that come in. They expect an A because they do what the syllabus says. Their grammar is terrible. Their spelling is terrible. Their papers are on time, but they're doing the minimum work. And these students are coming in, and they don't understand why they're not getting an A, because in the school, they got an A for doing what the minimum was.
Right.
Not A work. So, yeah, there needs to be changes, but we've become this nation. It's called the dumbing down of America, where the NEA, the National Education Association, has gotten it to where there's teachers that love to teach and they do a great job. So I'm not trying to paint everybody with one brushstroke, but this is something that's been permeating very slowly for many, many years to where they just are not teaching very well. I had experiences with our son when he was in middle school, and it was a teacher that was burned out. She had tenure, so she wasn't at risk of losing her job. And it was terrible. She didn't want to deal with the kids anymore. And you know, just go do your work. And you know, they shove the kids through the system now. So it needs to go back to the local level. It needs to, as far as I'm concerned, get out of the State Department of Education. Let's get it back down to the local level. Local control is always the best control. If you want to have standardized curriculum, that's fine, but don't make it where parents don't understand what's going on. Parents need to be involved in education. That's another question that came up to me today, was the states trying to get involved in areas that they don't belong in. And again, that's a state's powers issue, not a federal issue, but I can certainly see it becoming a federal issue, because once the states, just like Common Core, start off at the state level, the federal government jumps on top of it and says, oh, yes, include us too. Here, we'll take it over for you.
Yeah, exactly. And in the last remaining 5 minutes, I have another question. This one's from email from Melissa, who wants to know, speaking of center on school topic today, about school choice and high-stakes testing.
Okay, so high-stakes testing. So they have high stakes and low stakes. So a high test is a test that is used to make important decisions about the students, the educators, the schools, the districts, etc. So it's to make the schools, etc., more accountable. And are the students enrolled in effective schools? Are they being taught properly? Are they effective? So it's means testing. And so then the question is, well, then if the students don't score high enough, teaching to that test again, if the students don't test high enough or score high enough on their test, what kind of punishments are going to be passed down to that school district? Or what kind of accolades, awards, and celebration are they going to get? So that's what a high-stakes test is. Low-stakes test is not. It's just used to measure academic achievement, or to identify a learning problem, but it's not going to have some effect on the teacher or on the school district level. So I don't really have an opinion on it, one way or the other. It's something I have read very briefly on, but again, I'm going to state it goes back to getting it out of the state level, getting it back down to the local level. So that goes back to a state's powers issue.
Okay, and school choice, I'm assuming that Melissa is talking about vouchers and being in.
Yeah. Again, state issue. I am all for school vouchers. We had our kids in private education for many years. So we were paying not only for private education, but we were paying for a public education that they were not using. So we were double paying. And a lot of parents are doing that. They're paying for the kids to be in a private school because they want a better education. And I can tell you that when my kids came out of private school, they were 2 years ahead of their peers that were in public school. Kids are sponges. They can learn so much. So I think that there should be school vouchers. And I think that that's something that the state legislature needs to take up and allow. And of course, this goes back to unions. Unions don't want it because they get paid based on the number of students that are enrolled. Oregon is now over $11,000 per student is what the cost is. Oh.
And are we getting our money's worth, in your opinion?
No. They could do it so much more effectively. But they've just become, again, it's just symptomatic of what's going on at the federal level. They've gotten so big that they've lost touch and connection with what's really going on. A lot of parents aren't being involved because they face overload and that frustration that so many people do, that they just feel their voices are not being heard.
And speaking, that's a good segue, voices being heard. Gerald Ray, you will be back, I believe, on February 8th at this time.
That is what is on the calendar. So barring any unforeseen event, I will be back here on the 8th. The only reason that we reschedule is if I've got a public appearance somewhere. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of things coming up. So let me tell people what is coming up out there that I think that they would do very well to plug into. This coming weekend on Saturday up in Hillsboro is the Western Liberty Network candidate grassroots training event. They're going to have a debate with the U.S. Senate candidates as well as a debate with the state of Oregon governors. And there's going to be a lot of different training breakout sections. I think there's 16 different breakout sessions going on also. So that's they can look that up online at Western Liberty Network. The other big event coming up is going to be the following Saturday up in Portland at the Portland Convention Center. And that is the Oregon Family Freedom Rally. And Dinesh D'Souza is one of the speakers, as is Michelle Malkin is going to be a speaker. There's another gentleman, I don't remember his name off the top of my head, and then U.S. House Representative from the 2nd Congressional District, which is all of Eastern Oregon and parts of Western Oregon, Greg Walden. So those are the three key speakers. $35 a person for that includes lunch. And so that is a great event. So they can just go on to Oregon Family Council Freedom Rally 2016 and find that information. I will be at both of those events. And so I think people should plug into those. They're great events.
Please check them out. And if I can say, if you have a question, send Joe Ray an email. Joe Ray, one more time real quick, the address again?
Is Perkins, the number 4, Oregon.com. Excuse me, Perkins4Oregon.com. Yes, that will get you to my website, and the email is attached there.
Great. And thanks a lot again, Joe Ray, for coming. And we'll see you again in February 8th.
Sounds good. We'll see you then. Thank you for the questions, everyone.
Hang on.
And we're out.
Yeah, we're clear. I'm just... clicking buttons here.
Now I got to figure this stupid Skype out. It's like,
I'm also thinking too.